Welcome to Out of School, the podcast about the intersection of technology and education. My name is Bradley Chambers. I'm joined today by Cole Conrad. Frazier is out of town this week, so I thought of bringing Cole to talk about what his school has been up to this year. So we'll bring Cole on in just a few minutes. But first, I want to thank our sponsors very quickly, and you'll hear more about them as the show goes on. First, Jamf Software, and second, a new book called Stop Getting IT Wrong. So more about them as the show goes on. Cole, how's it going?
Good. How are you, brother?
Good, good. It is Friday as we are recording, and I am inching towards 5 o'clock, so I cannot wait.
That's great. I'm luckily off today.
Ah.
Just took a vacation day.
School just started, and you already took a day off?
Yeah, I try not to take any time off during the summer because I just don't feel like I have the ability. So I took some time, and I'm at a point now where I've got to take the days because if I don't, I'm going to lose them.
See, our vacation schedule is a little bit different. Like, I only get a handful of like personal days, but then I get like various times off that the entire school's off. But ours resets in August. It's like my goal is to take zero personal days from August to December, and then I have four to take from like January to May.
Yeah, we do. You earn a day that is a personal / sick multi-use day every pay period. So it racks up pretty quick, but once you hit 30, they fall off if you don't use them.
So your personal time and sick time is lumped into one.
Yeah,
that's
all
nice.
One big bucket.
Oh, that's nice. I mean, like, because I've got like 36 days built up. And they keep expiring because you can only like accumulate 30. But yeah, that's nice. I guess I could take mental health days.
Yeah. Well, after summer implementation, that's probably what today is considered.
Ah, nice, nice. So I guess before we get rolling with what you guys are up to, let's thank one of our sponsors, Jamf Software, as I'm sure we'll talk about throughout the show because you guys are customers of theirs. They provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in education. Now, with Casper Focus, they have placed these powerful technologies directly into the hands of teachers that work with students every day. Casper Focus enables teachers to unlock the full potential of the iPad in the classroom by ensuring that all students are engaged on the same activity and using their iOS devices in the way it was intended. Learn more at JAMFsoftware.com, and we'll have a link to the website in the show notes. And if you're a Casper customer already, you know, the Casper suite, version 9 is out. So have you guys rolled out version 9 yet?
No, I took the approach that we'll probably wait till winter break. We're still running the latest version of 8, but version 9, I've been running the betas on a separate server. And it's good, but it makes enough changes, and we're still not staffed out enough to like handle a big system change like that without the possibility of something going wrong.
Well, and I think, you know, Frazier was a new Casper customer, so I think it made more sense for him to go ahead and roll the dice on the upgrade because you guys had an existing infrastructure that you basically were growing.
Yeah, that's my main thing is I've had to learn the hard way with other systems like our web filter and things like that. While I don't think the JSS and Casper as a whole is probably going to have as many issues as maybe web filter firmware upgrade would, it's still just a lot to take on, and we've got about a year worth of experience and knowledge with 8, so we can get around and be flexible, and 9 might have stood in the way of that until we can kind of play with it a little bit more.
Well, that makes sense. You often wish like the vendors, and I know their development cycles are different, but like give us an update in May and so we can test it and have it ready for August.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I've been running the beta on one of our old, we transitioned from one server to the other. So I just went ahead and upgraded the old database and said, let's take a look at it. And it's been nice. As far as looking at it, it's got a lot of new things in it, but, that change isn't ready yet. We're hoping to staff up here a little bit, and maybe we'll be able to train on it first. And then really, you know, we're at a point scale-wise where we need to do more planning whenever we make changes, even simple ones. It definitely requires more planning than it used to maybe 2 years ago.
Well, because how many staff and students are you guys supporting now?
Staff, we've got about 180, and students – If we're fully enrolled, probably around 1,500 to 1,600. Right now we're at about 1,300.
Yeah, so just even a minor interface change is something, I mean, that's a lot that you have to communicate.
Yeah, it's a lot to push out, and just on our aspect from the back end, just making those changes. Our newest staff member, who really works with the JSS the most, I've kind of transitioned a lot of that to him. He's only been working in it since January, and he didn't have any formal training from Casper, or from Jamf, rather. So he's still kind of learning his ways through 8, and I wouldn't want to throw 9 at him just yet.
I guess we should probably actually introduce you again. We kind of jumped right into that discussion, but, you know, you were on the show back on episode 22, so it's been 30 episodes ago. So if somebody's a new listener, tell them a little about who you are and where you're from and what you do.
Sure. So I am the IT director for Gestalt Community Schools here in Memphis, Tennessee. I work at the Charter Management Organization, that kind of acts like what a typical local model would consider a district, in supporting centrally all of our schools technologically. So all the technology that goes in, all the different systems, I have almost always got a hand in it. And we've got 4 campuses and 5 different schools within those campuses now. And we are growing every year, adding more schools. But that's what I do day to day, is kind of just a mixed bag of all of it. Jumping into all of our different technology and planning for our upcoming technology and things like E-rate and all that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah, E-rate, that's a complicated thing. Anytime you're dealing with any sort of government money, that can be complicated.
Yeah, it's a lot of, I don't know what the best word of it for it is, but you basically have to plan your, let's call it your fiscal year of technology. If that begins, that has to begin July 1 of the year. But you have to have all of that infrastructure that you're going to put in, all of your internet providers, all your contracts signed and ready to go. All that planning has to be done by early March, and submitted to the government so that they can go ahead and review it and start working on getting it approved to get your discount, which is substantial depending on your free or reduced lunch numbers. excuse me. And the students we serve, our population qualifies us for about a 90% discount. So it's definitely something that we work hard to make sure we get in and on time and correct.
It's free money, essentially. I mean, if you turn it down, you've got to make up that money somewhere.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, with the way we're structured, our pipes are kind of the biggest thing. Our internet pipes, our network pipes, those are the core of what we do and what we need. Because we have so much technology in the schools that relies on content providers or centralized servers at our flagship school, where we kind of keep our mini data center, half rack worth of data center. So we need big pipes to do that, and that can get expensive when you're using things like fiber. So 90% back is huge.
No, it's free money. We get a little bit from E-rate. We, based on our student population, we have to have, I think, 5 kids who would qualify for free or reduced lunch, even though we don't offer it, but they would qualify. So you get a little. It's money we don't really include in our budget because it's not enough. But it's kind of extra money when it comes in. It's good kind of rainy day money. If something breaks or you have an upgrade you didn't plan on, or you know, something you forgot to budget for, it's nice, a little extra. We had a show about RenWeb a few weeks ago. Basically, it was episode 48, hypercritical on student information systems, or SIS is what I called it. And I know you guys are a power school. I'm assuming you listened to the show, cause I think we talked about it, offline.
Yeah.
How is PowerSchool? Tell me a little about your love and gripes with PowerSchool.
I mean, that was definitely your angry episode. I think that's what I said online, because it was clear that your student information system could just be a fight some days. And, for us, I mean, with PowerSchool, it's definitely way more helpful than it is harmful for us and everything that we do. It's extremely useful. It's for us, we really are trying to build it out to be our single source of data whenever it comes to, if I want to pull as much information for a scholar, that's our system where we want to get that data into typically, or we want to be able to tie these other systems together based on what PowerSchool has, because that's our single source of truth for student information. I mean, we're still kind of using it in the out-of-the-box fashion. It's been customized a little bit, but PowerSchool is extremely flexible. Pearson, I do believe they're striving to do the absolute best they can with their product. They've started to put out monthly releases so that they are always listening and taking the biggest features that are voted up within their kind of it's not a forum, but their customer support. I mean, there's forums and there's so many things as far as resources for how to use PowerSchool. They take their feature requests that get voted up the most, and they try to work those into every monthly release and then what they call their back-to-school release during the summer, which is the big release. And so they're really striving with the product, and it relies on a lot of modern technologies as far as CSS, HTML, MySQL, and JavaScript, which makes it flexible in that if you can learn those systems, or if you do web design or web development work outside, you can kind of slide into doing this type of work, which I did go to college for web design. So it kind of, it takes me back to what I went to college for. And you can go in there and customize the system. We use it just to house our data for the most part, but you can run your lunch process through it, everything like that. Report cards go out through it. We use a separate system for communicating with our parents and our scholars. So really, it's a database in its strictest fashion right now. But we are really looking to customize it and build it out to make it something bigger, to accept more data, and to make the job of the different people within our organization much easier. Things like data validation on the fly. So if you put something in and you forgot to put in, say, the gender or the date of birth for a scholar, we want PowerSchool to tell you that so that you don't have to find out later whenever you run the state report that you got to go back and fix that. There's a lot of things that it can do like that, but out of the box, it just doesn't do. It tries not to get in your way. You can make it get in your way if you want it to. So, I mean, PowerSchool has been a big win for us because we moved from a tool called TeacherEase whenever we were just a single school. And a lot of people loved TeacherEase, but it was designed, and they told us that it was specifically designed for single school use. If you're going to have multiple sites and multiple locations to manage, their tool just was not designed to do it. It also wasn't a true database the way PowerSchool is. We can get almost anything we want out of PowerSchool once we get it in there. We can push it to other systems. It's a fantastic tool, and day to day it can be fairly complex to work with though.
Do they have fairly decent iOS apps?
You know, I check into the iOS apps. I probably need to do more QA for our scholars and our staff, but they have different apps. So they have one for administrators, they have one for teachers, and they have one for parents, and they have one for scholars. They actually have four different apps. That way you get a different experience with each one. I was using one the other day, and it, the setup process is probably one thing I'd be concerned about. How is a student or a parent going to know what to plug in if I want to get my PowerSchool information? I just have my login and my password. And it was actually very straightforward. I went ahead and tested it as a scholar, and you just walk through multiple steps, like four steps, and it asks you for your zip code, and it finds the school within Pearson's system, and it automatically has all your information enclosed as far as the URL and if you're using SSL and all that fun stuff. And it just drops you onto a login page, and you go in and have access to the data that we want you to have access to. That part's a little bit kind of tightened up as far as what I'm saying, how flexible PowerSchool is. There's a set of things you're allowed to see, like grades and attendance and things like that, but you can't add to Pearson's app out and on the go if you wanted to push something that you started storing in there, like discipline. if the discipline didn't come out of the box as far as positive and negative behavior, you can't get to it. But for the most part, it does a pretty nice job.
RenWeb recently added one of my huge a feature to address one of my huge complaints is like the ability to dump mail, like address labels, like the automatic mail label creation report to Excel. And like that was huge. That saved me a ton of time running some reports this week. I don't know about you guys, but like August and September, I end up running a ton of reports from just various, like a lot of times it's for our director of development, just various things for grants that we're doing or just various events that we're getting going. Like, you know, I mentioned on a past show, this is our school's 60th anniversary. So we got a lot of stuff going on with that. You know, the reporting, the inability of it to be simple has really been frustrating, but at least we got one thing added. So that was good. But before we move on, let's go ahead and thank our next sponsor. It's a new book that's actually coming out, and I've read the book, and it's actually a lot of fun to read. So it's Stop Getting IT Wrong, and the website before we get started is stopgettingitwrong.com, and we'll have links to that and the book links for on the Amazon store in the show notes. So if you don't write it down, that's fine. Just look on the notes at outofschool.net. Have you ever wondered if you could be teaching smarter by using technology to your advantage? Do you feel as though you've got a fortune of gadgets sitting around and they're not helping your students learn? Then this book is for you. So Stop Getting IT Wrong is a comprehensive collection of musings and strategies about successful use of digital technology in any classroom and at any level. Whether you're a computer science teacher or you teach dance, there's something in this book to help you teach smarter. It collects the best practices of over 7 years teaching in computers and digital technology every day. Brought to you by a passionate teacher who genuinely believes that every lesson can be made better just by using technology we already have at our fingertips. It's available for from Amazon as a paperback for $9.99 in pounds or $13.38 in U.S. dollars. Or you can get it for $3 for the Kindle in pounds, or I'm sorry, 3 pounds for the Kindle and $4.66 in U.S. dollars for the Kindle, and it's coming soon to the iBook store. Again, I read the book. It's actually really funny. Like it's one of those like books that you'll laugh, but you're like laughing because and you're like, oh, I know what he's talking about. Like it's a really well written book and it's a lot of fun to read. So if you're working at a school, you'll really really enjoy it. So stopgettingitwrong.com. Again, show notes at outofschool.net. Yeah, you know, I really love like when books are just inexpensive like that. When I can just buy a digital book for a couple dollars. I don't know. I like that trend.
Yeah, I mean, I'm way more likely to buy it if it's $5 or less.
So, I don't think we've talked about it on this show, but I wrote an article a few weeks ago about like how regular people have no idea how to manage photos on their iPhone, and they got passed around by Daring Fireball, the unofficial Apple web blog, Gizmodo, and threw me quite a bit of traffic to my blog naturally. So I decided to write a little short ebook on how I manage my photos, and I'm going to sell it for like $3. The planned release is the 16th of September, but I'm really just waiting on Apple to approve the iBooks version. So you can pre-order the PDF at chambersdaily.com. As with my Evernote interactive book, the iTunes store brought a ton of the traffic, so I wanted to get it up there as well. So, I originally thought like $5, but I thought like, let's go $3 and try to make it as an instant purchase as possible. And because again, like whether I sell, 20 or 2,000, my costs are the same on the digital book. My cost is already, I've got a sunk cost into it. And so just the more I can sell, even at a less price, the more I can make.
Yeah. And, obviously you got economies of scale there too, right? I mean, the more people that are willing to buy it, because like I said, $5 is typically my threshold before I'm going to double check if I really want to pay for it. Although I did buy Learning to Love Evernote and I've watched some of it, and I did find a little bit of irony in that I tried to put one of your videos into Evernote and it was too big.
That is funny. Yeah. Somebody asked me about that once, I have that plan to do an update to the book and add some more screencasts. But I finished it in late May, went on sale in mid May. And then we moved and then we went on vacation. Then I had another kid and my personal life has been in much in much flux really since I released that thing. And I really, you know, when that article got passed around, I started thinking I need to write just a quick book on how to do this. And it's mainly text and photos. There's no video. And I really get the idea I got both ideas for these books from people asking me questions. Like, cause somebody even asked me earlier, what's your next book? And I said, I don't have any idea. I guess it depends on what people start asking me, because I kept getting a lot of questions about Evernote until I did the Learning to Love Evernote. And then I get all kinds of questions about like photo management, you know, from local people here in Chattanooga that I know, and then people on the internet. So I thought, you know, like I'm going to like try to at least maybe have a place to point them. And then if I can make a little money in the process, like that's a win-win as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I just started writing. Probably it might've been the last time I was on, started writing on my blog, and that's kind of slowed down the whole idea of writing. It just can come and go as far as having the drive to do it. But it's great to see you putting out some books and kind of sharing your expertise with some of the things that you've noticed. Because what I found interesting about that article, your post about the photos and how popular it got, was it was such a simple concept that you just kind of summed up. That's what a lot of writing is sometimes, is you can see it, but you've got to share it.
No, you're right. And share it in a way that makes sense. And, you know, this book is only 20 pages long. And so I know some people might think, well, that's like, you know, that's not a lot of pages, but the book is, you know, aimed at like regular people. Like it's aimed at like my wife, like understands her iPhone, like she takes pictures with it and all that. But like the methodology of backing up, like she doesn't think about that. And of course, you know, the argument I made on the article is that like regular people shouldn't have to think about it. And that's the premise of the book. Like the first sentence of the description is like, this book shouldn't exist, shouldn't need to exist, but it does. So like, I tried to make it as simple as possible. Like, you know, if I'm trying to like it, you know, a good example is I had to restring my weed eater a couple months ago, and I found a YouTube video that was like 2 minutes long, or I could have read the instruction manual that was like 50 pages long. Well, the YouTube video was simple and I figured it out, and that's ultimately served its purpose. And so if I can, you know, this isn't meant to be a fan fiction novel, or, you know, it's just meant to be like getting you the information on how to save your photos in case your phone fell into the lake.
Yeah. Well, it was definitely a good read.
Well, thank you. So what else have you guys, like, what else have you done new this year? Have you rolled out?
So this year we made a pretty drastic addition to our computing for our scholars. You know, we've been a pretty much strictly Apple shop ever since we opened our doors, but this year was a big year of growth, about 130% growth across the board. And when we looked at the money, we said, let's at least check some other alternatives, and one of those was Chromebooks, and we have implemented about 1,000 Chromebooks this summer.
You know, you guys operate on so much bigger scale than I do. You know, it's like, oh, we're going to check out this new thing. Oh, yeah, we'll just roll out 1,000 of them.
last week I was listening. I was listening to, I believe it was last week's episode, or actually it was 2 weeks ago, when you had the two guys on. Oh, I'm terrible at remembering. They were talking about Chromebooks and tablet, Android tablet deployments.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how, you know, we are in our first stage of our rollout. It's one of those things that I'm striving for as our organization continues to grow, because putting 1,000 machines out, it took a lot of time, and it was just intense. I mean, one of the ways that we thought we would go kind of against the grain, maybe, and I think that this is actually a really, really great thing we're going to continue to explore, is we actually employed five of our scholars, our high school scholars. So we gave them a job for 2 weeks to help us in general with imaging of our MacBooks, because we have about 1,000 MacBooks, MacBook Pros, and 1,000 Chromebooks, to get them unboxed and prepped. And I can tell you that there's a big difference between the two. Whenever it comes to deploying Apple's equipment the imaging process, if you do it every year, which we tend to do, it is extremely time-consuming in comparison to the Chromebook deployment, where it's really just turning them on, making sure they update, and enrolling them into your organization. And for our needs, you know, when I was talking about our pipes earlier, one of the reasons we went with the Chromebooks was we do so much. We just started looking at how much we were doing in the browser and how much we still could do in the browser that we weren't yet doing, like Office 365. And we went ahead and we said we'll give it a shot. But when we gave it a shot, it was basically taking 50% of our deployment is now Google products. And so far, it's been extremely easy to use. The Google Apps dashboard actually works, which is great. Whenever you need to make a change or you need to figure something out, for instance, do you all do NWEA testing?
No.
Okay. We use that heavily for benchmark testing, just to find out where our scholars are at. At the beginning of the year, so they test typically late summer or first week or two of school, sometimes in the middle of the year, and then at the end of the year. And that just lets us track their growth in their understanding of the different concepts that they're taught throughout the year, where they were at the beginning, where they're at the end. It gives us a ton of information that I don't know how to read, but our academic team does. But this year we went ahead and we were kind of stuck with how do we do this on Chromebooks? Because the NWEA system, their web version of their system, which is extremely, extremely nice, it uses a lockdown browser on OS X or Windows to make sure that the only thing the scholars are doing is testing. They can't do anything else without completely quitting the test. And so we were wondering, how do we do this on a Chromebook? And so we had to, right off the bat, come up with kind of a deployment for NWEA within the first 2 weeks of school. And what that boiled down to was creating a single user, because one thing I wasn't sure of is you can have one user logged into multiple Chromebooks, as in like 500 in our case, at the same time. And it works. I wasn't sure if there was going to be a profile or syncing issue. I mean, one thing they didn't get to do was install any extensions or anything like that. That might cause mayhem if one person installs something and 499 people then have to get it. Because it's syncing the whole experience. But basically what we did was we created that one user. We put them into their own organization within Google Apps. So it was just a sub-organization for each school. And then I went in, and when you're in the Google Apps dashboard, you can go to the Services tab, and you can shut off all the terms and services. So Gmail, Drive, all of that stuff got turned off. The only thing we left flipped on for that account was the Chrome management, which is the portion of the dashboard that lets you manage the Chrome browser and experience. And on a Chromebook, that's all you get whenever you log in. So it really allowed us to then take that profile, that organization, and say the only thing you can get to, you're whitelisted to only get to these, you know, three websites, and you're blacklisted from everything else on the internet. So we did a lockdown browser in kind of an opposite format. We didn't install anything. We kind of just subtracted what they were allowed to get to and said you can only get to these three things, and it worked. And we made the change once, and we said it was a Friday that we were probably really testing everything, and on Monday they started testing, and it worked. So, I mean, the experience with the Chromebooks has been smooth and streamlined, and it's definitely been helpful in the way of deployment. We'll see how the repair process goes as we kind of move down the road with them.
Which model did you guys go with again?
We went with the Samsung 503Cs, I believe is what they are, 303Cs.
How has the battery life been?
It's been good. It's been 6 to 7 hours. It's been comparable to our MacBooks.
That's not bad. Yeah. You know, kind of shifting gears here, when you think about your you know, I think we talked last show how, you know, you built one campus and you replicate it basically when you build a new one. In terms of your wireless network, you know, you guys, and that's actually how you and I became friends, was over your Aerohive deployment. When are you thinking about 802.11ac in your timeline? Like, what are you guys thinking there?
That goes back to the whole planning thing. Right now, we're such doers that we're always doing things and not always planning. And as an organization, especially with this department, we're trying to get better at that, which really just means freeing up the time of some people, probably me to start, and looping in some other people on the staff to do that. I haven't thought about the AC standard or implementation too much. I haven't thought about it too much. I saw that Aerohive is going to have a webinar in a couple of weeks to kind of go over it, because you are much more of a wireless guru than I am. You have much better understandings of the inner workings and of what's coming. You're kind of keeping your thumb on that. I'm typically keeping my thumb on everything just a little bit, but not nearly able to dive into one thing. So I'm not sure where we're going to go with that yet. I can say that I don't know if this makes a difference, but with the Chromebooks, I have noticed that the wireless chips inside of them, they are probably pretty cheap. Because if you set a MacBook next to it, it will get a full signal, whereas the Chromebook might get 2 out of 3 bars.
Well, yeah, and it's probably, you know, it may, you know, I'm wondering what chip it has, and I may have to research that to see. Because if, you know, again, if they're trying to keep the cost down, that's certainly a place you could cut a little bit of the cost. Of course, the MacBook Pro, I know, has a 3-stream chip. The MacBook Airs are 2-stream. And then I'm wondering if those are single stream in the Chromebooks. Because I noticed, like, my iPhone will get less than a MacBook Air. And a lot has to do with kind of like the power of the chip and things like that. You know, it's a tough thing for schools because, you know, your largest problem with wireless is not speed, and neither is mine. It's really nobody's right now, and that's what we, you know, it's almost like most people are touting AC, you know, this great new speed, when I would dare say that majority of you, your problems with your wireless network are not speed. It's bad implementations. It's, you know, just, you know, bad deployments. You know, it's not enough density and things like that. And so I think for you guys and us too, because we have such kind of late 802.11 end deployments, I'm not in any rush to move to an all AC network. If anything, I'm in a holding pattern because we just, you know, did a big deployment this spring and over the summer. And so I will have no new devices on campus for a couple of years. And so everything we have is 802.11n. And the only place I might move to 802.11ac is in some of the common areas. Like, I can, you know, pop out, you know, move and, you know, buy a couple of AC access points and then pop the, and, you know, shift stuff around in common areas, just to help with some density overload, could do that. But I'm really happy with my network right now. And if I can hang out until wave 2 of 802.11ac, which that'll come, I think, in 2015, when that's supposed to kind of be rolling, the plan is for that'll get us multi-user MIMO. And kind of in a nutshell, that's moving us closer to wireless switching. You know, so wireless, you're essentially using hubs in the air. You know, it's a shared medium. Like, if you're talking, I can't be talking, and vice versa. Or switching, it's kind of more intelligent. Well, with multi-user MIMO, we're getting us to closer to wireless switching. And so that'll be a big thing, especially in higher density situations. You'll be able to do just a lot more. So I'm just going to hang on. And I wrote an article about it on Chambers Daily, and I'll put a link into the show notes about it. Basically, like, when should you upgrade? And, you know, the too long didn't read version was, if you've got an, you know, obviously if you've got an 802.11g network, or you've got a really early 802.11n network, like you deployed it, you know, back in 2009, right when it was ratified, then I might look at moving to an AC network very soon. You know, it's probably about time to do that. But, like, you know, you and I have deployments that are less than 2 years old. I'm running fine. Like, everything's working great. I just would see no benefit of ripping that out and putting in, you know, 40 AC access points.
Yeah, and the rip and replace model, like, because we're in the public space with our schools, you know, E-rate kind of dictates how you're supposed to use the funds, which the funds that we get from E-rate, you know, those are used for infrastructure purchases. So those are used for wiring, wireless, and then basically internet and telephone. And you're supposed to, if you buy anything with E-Rate, you're supposed to buy, hold on to it for at least 3 to 5 years, I believe, is the length of time you're supposed to have it. It has to stay at the entity that purchased it for at least that long. So it kind of, that somewhat dictates with us because we can't really make a change, and not get that, you know, 80 to 90% back. It just doesn't make financial sense to make those changes. So that kind of dictates a little bit of our plan.
Well, and again, it just goes back to, even if you could, you know, you just, the longer you wait, the more, the, you know, the nicer stuff you'll get in the future. It's the same reason I try to wait and get a new computer, keep my old computers as long as possible. The longer you can hold on to something, the nicer stuff you'll get.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I worked on an 11-inch Air as long as I could until I had to go to something else, and then I moved up to a Pro. And I'm planning on using that for at least another 3 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll keep my current MacBook Air for at least 3 years, if not four, because I wish I'd waited around and got the next Air, and then I could have had an 8 to 11 AC in it. But, you know, what are you going to do? That's dollar short and a day late. So any predictions for the Apple announcement next week?
No, I know friend of the show, Stephen Hackett, he wrote yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, about, he basically reposted something from, I don't remember his name, about fingerprint scanners, and the possibility of use. And I think the fingerprint reader on the home button, it's seeming more and more likely. And I really think that that would be interesting because it is Craig Hockenberry. That's the person who wrote it. He wrote a whole bunch of different uses for the fingerprint reader on a iPhone, how that could be unique to, you know, unlocking apps themselves. So, I mean, even the idea of, I think the idea of user profiles may not ever come to iOS as far as you can actually log in and then you can log out like you do on your computer. But what if you had an application that allowed you, whenever you used your fingerprint, to give you your profile within that app? And then whenever you closed out of it, if somebody else came up and they put their fingerprint on it, they're going to get their information. I'm thinking like 1Password. That would be excellent. You could have your own, you know, passwords. But you don't have to have multiple users on your devices.
Or games, like high scores and save games and things like that. Email accounts, iCloud accounts.
That'd be huge.
Well, and you could kind of get rid of the passcode, you know, having to keep a locked passcode on it. Of course, you know, Android did something like that a few years ago. They did like the facial scanner, but of course, I think like some guy shaved and it didn't work. And fingerprints, you know, since they're fairly unique. I think that might be a little bit better. Are you on an iPhone 5 now, or what are you?
Yeah, I've actually been meaning to write about it because I kind of had an iPhone 4. I had an iPhone 4 for a while, and it just, I put the iOS 7s on it, and it just was dog slow after that. And so I talked to work. I was, you know, outside of my 2 years, I'd had it for 2 years. So I could get an iPhone 5, and I got one, and I'm very happy with it. I don't know what the 5S or the new thing could have that would make me want to move away from it. I mean, the fingerprint reader would be nice, but not necessary. But I'll tell you, I was just amazed with how much of a difference. I know I jumped ahead two cycles, but the iPhone 5 is just an amazing device.
Yeah, I'm very happy with mine. You know, I'm still have a year left on my contract with AT&T, so I won't be getting a 5S unless someone wanted to send me a free one, and then I would gladly take it. And if you would like to do that, you can email me. I'll give you my shipping address. No problems at all. But, you know, it's just so much of it is software-driven. I mean, you know, Steve Jobs said it a few years ago, software is the soul. And, of course, you know, I'm running the iOS 7 beta, and I really, really like it. And again, I'm sure there will be something specific, you know, to the new hardware, the fingerprint sensor, something else. But, you know, I'm kind of on the non-S cycle where I got the iPhone 4, iPhone 5. I like being on that cycle.
Yeah, you usually get, you know, the big features first, and then, you know, the S cycle is more either the add-ons or the bumps.
yeah.
you know, in speed or, you know, new technology that's out. But it's not usually the big new features.
So, yeah, we'll see. That event is September the 10th, so we shall see. So anything else you guys have done this school year that's been interesting, or any issues y'all ran into?
This school year, we just learned a lot about scale. Whenever you make a big jump, this was our biggest growth year thus far, and I think it's one of two of our biggest growth years in our 5-year plan. So we just learned a lot about how much the workload kind of grows whenever you add so many devices. I mean, we could have used those 5 scholars for a solid month or two with the amount of work that ended up needing to get done. And so that's kind of trickled on into our school year, which is not what we want. So, you know, that's been the biggest thing we've learned this year. I tried to make sure we didn't implement too much new stuff this year. The Chromebooks, there were a lot of reasons, one of the biggest being the financial and also the most responsible option. For us, you know, elementary and middle school scholars, they can work well on Chromebooks, whereas our high school is still running on a 1-to-1 MacBook program. So the biggest thing we learned this year that we did this year was just realize how much time it takes whenever you double or more than double what you're trying to support, what you're putting in place. But as far as new technologies, we use Aerohive for our wireless. We've got Cisco backbone for all of our wired networking. And we use Casper and Google to kind of manage our devices. And that's kind of our core there. And then we've got about 10 to 15 data systems that I'm involved with. And that's my next big project, is to wrap all those up and automate the way they all talk to each other and work. Because we just use all of these different content providers and systems to provide our data-driven instruction.
Well, you know, again, you've got 1,000 more students than we do across multiple campuses. And so you have to think about things at different levels than I do or Fraser does, because just, the scale, I mean, small changes here aren't that big of a deal, but small changes for 1,300 students and, you know, 100-plus faculty members, that you just have to think through little things. Like, everything has to be kind of communicated ahead of time and perfectly.
Yeah, communication is key. That's definitely one thing that I've been learning this year, is you've got to share out. And you've always got to be thinking, you know, with where we're at and we're not done growing, you know, what we put in place now has to last us, and it also has to be able to scale and grow, because we're moving steadily towards 5,000 scholars. That's where we'll be within 3 years. So it's just, you have to put in the right pieces years ahead of time, so when you get to that 5,000, you don't experience the growing pains in mass.
Well, yeah, that's, again, a lot harder problems than I have, no doubt. I guess we'll wrap it up there, right at 40 minutes or so. And I know you've got to enjoy your day off. And thankfully, it's Friday here, so I'm going to get my week wrapped up and enjoy hopefully a lazy Saturday. Of course, it's not too lazy with 2 kids. Yeah. My lazy time starts at about 5 a.m. and ends about 5:25 a.m. It's my coffee time.
Yeah.
So Cole, thanks for being on the show. I know you had lunch with friend of the show, Stephen Hackett, today. And, of course, it's my new goal that anytime I'm on a podcast, I have to mention Stephen's name. So that's my new goal. So Stephen's a great guy. And we'll have a link to his blog in the show notes, where link to Craig Hockenberry's about the article about the fingerprint sensor, because that's very interesting. Craig Hockenberry of the Icon Factory, who they make Twitterific, if you've never used that Twitter app. So, Cole, where can we find you on the internet if someone wants to learn more about you?
You can find me on Twitter and app.net at DABIGC. That's the big C. And my website, which has lacked some posts for a couple weeks now, but I am kind of amassing a big drafts folder, so I'm going to probably start pushing some things out here on vacation in about a week. That's at coursecode.net.
Well, awesome. Well, again, if you don't follow me on Twitter, it's at Bradley Chambers and on the web at chambersdaily.com. Frazier will be back next week, and we've got a fun topic ahead. So, Cole, thanks for coming on, and hope everybody has a great week.
No problem. Thanks.